Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. Now, let me remind everyone right off the bat that I will be making two appearances in Western Europe, and these will be the only ones of the year, as far as I know, for what's left of the year. And this involves, first of all, on Monday, the 26th of October, there will be a conference, an anti-NATO conference, under the heading No Guerra, No NATO. And that will be in Rome, Italy, at the Centro Convegni Cavour, the Cavour Conference Center, C-A-V-O-U-R. And that is in Via Cavour, so C-A-V-O-U-R, Via Cavour, 50A, Rome. And that will be from 10 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock in the evening. And you can check the various web pages to see exactly who of those invited is now likely to appear. But I will appear for sure. And I hope that friends and contacts in Italy and beyond who find it convenient to get to Rome come by, because what we'll do is improvise a meeting of an informal meeting of friends and supporters of the Tax Wall Street Party and the United Front Against Austerity somewhere on the margins of this conference. It might even turn out to be the day of. It could be lunch the day of, or dinner the day of, or maybe lunch or dinner or the afternoon of the day after, something like this. But there will be a gathering of contact. So that's Rome, October 26th. I'll repeat this later in the broadcast. And then on Halloween, right, October 31st and November 1st. Actually, I'll be speaking on November 1st, as far as I know, but come and see what else is available at this conference. This is Querdenken, Q-U-E-R-D-E-N-K-E-N. So it means thinking out of the box, I would say, in English. And that's in Friedberg, F-R-I-E-D-B-E-R-G, close to Frankfurt am Main. So we're in the Rhine-Main area of Germany, right? You know, Mainz, Wiesbaden, Frankfurt, well, Friedberg. And that's up there near, what is it, Bad Nauheim, where Elvis Presley did his military service. But this is Friedberg. So October 31st, November 1st, and you can find that under QUER-DENKEN-KONGRESS.DE. Look that up on the internet. You'll find these links, by the way, on my Twitter feed. That is to say, Webster G. Tarpley. Go to Webster G. Tarpley. Go back a few days, and you will find the lowdown on these conferences. So hope to see people on Monday the 26th in Rome, Italy, and then on October 31st, November 1st in the Frankfurt area of Germany. And the same thing goes for Frankfurt. We will hopefully have some kind of an informal meeting of friends, sympathizers, contacts of the Tax Wall Street Party, United Front Against Austerity, and with a view to expanding operations in Europe. Because let everybody know, this is an international movement. This is not limited to the United States. We don't need country by country organizations at this point. The point is precisely to have an international approach. In other words, learn the lesson of Greece. The Greeks have been temporarily defeated, and one of the big reasons was that they were organized on a Greeks-only basis, one country at a time. It's a hopeless proposition. When your adversary, finance capital, is organized into Bilderberger, trilateral, three continents, and so forth, and then when you're dealing with the 18 countries of Euroland and the 29 countries, I think it is, of the European Union, one country has no chance. And the point of that is you've got to do that from the word go. That's not something you can improvise at the end of a long process of organizing. You got to have that built in from the very beginning. So that's what we propose to do. The idea is to have an international philosophical association, call that the United Front Against Austerity, and then articulate that into political expressions. But don't start dividing, subdividing at this early time, because it's way premature, and it sets you up for precisely the bad habits that the Greeks are paying for so dearly, right? The fact that they were isolated, and in those European Council meetings, they really didn't have anybody that they could count on. Nobody was prepared to go down the line for them, because, of course, they had not signified that they would do that for somebody else. It's always a two-way street. But when you're dealing with finance capital, dear friends, they are organized internationally, and you better be organized internationally also. Narrow chauvinism gets you nothing except defeat. So, this morning, we're recording our program early because of the vicissitudes of this trip. So we're coming to you now on Thursday, the 22nd of October, and a little bit earlier in the day than usual. But we're still looking at lots and lots of clown show going on here. And right now, it's the Benghazi Committee, the House Benghazi Committee, right, run by Mr. Slickums, Trey Gowdy. I think the Trey is French for very, and I don't know what very we can put on this guy, but very intelligent he is not. Maybe very unscrupulous would be the case. And we'll get to this in just a minute. But let's just point out a couple of things in the really big picture. We're going to be heavy on domestic this time. I know some people like that, but let's get a little bit of international context. Remember now, we put out a warning last weekend, which was simply that Obama is losing power in his own administration. And this is undoubted. All of those security breaches, all of those drones, and all kinds of other things have gone on, so that essentially the neocon faction and their close allies, the humanitarian bombers, both of them militaristic, aggressive, and ultimately quite suicidal for the United States, they've been gaining power. So Obama's power, at least momentarily, waning, and then this question of the neocons getting more power. And when I say neocons, don't just think, you know, the Committee for a New American Century or something like this, right? It's not just some chicken hawk like William Kristol. We're talking General David Petraeus. We're talking John Allen, the hopefully now definitively outgoing ISIS czar who has done so much damage, has set the stage for the current difficulties by his phony war policy. All of that is happening, but we want to fight back. Now, the first thing is let's look at Assad in Moscow, and that I think is a very interesting moment. Right, it is as has been pointed out in much of the news, a lot of the stuff has been said about this Assad meeting. Right, the New York Times is attempting to push this line that this was not a cooperative conference. Here we go. Bashar al-Assad finds chilly embrace in Moscow, writes the New York Times, October 21st. We'll be right back on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. And as I mentioned in the first segment, if you are in Italy, please come to the No Guerra, No NATO conference in Rome, via Cavour in Rome. And that's on Monday, the 26th of October, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. I will be there, and we will have time either that day or the day after, I guess, to to put together an informal gathering of supporters of the Tax Wall Street Party, and then on to the Frankfurt area of Germany on Halloween weekend, October 31st, November 1st, that is in Friedberg, for the Querdenken Congress. And that is thinking out of the box, thinking across the existing lines, I guess. And we'll try to have a gathering of various contacts there. And then, of course, other speakers, take a look at the respective websites of these. So I'll repeat that again, but you can also find it on my Twitter feed, that is to say Webster G. Tarpley. Now, Assad in Moscow. The first time Assad has left Syria, as far as we know, and that would be in, since the early spring of 2011, so it's 4 or 5 years, but finally he went to meet with Putin in the Kremlin. And I would say there's every indication that this was a productive and harmonious meeting. They have every reason to be optimistic because, of course, the combined operation, that is the Syrian Arab army on the ground, backed up by Hezbollah, backed up by Iran, is gaining. The terrorist rebels controlled by the CIA, and I was laughing again yesterday at CNN about the moderate rebels. They were looking for moderate rebels, right? Who was the guy who went around looking for the honest man? Was it Diogenes looking for an honest man? You're going to look until your life is over to find a moderate terrorist rebel. Or better yet, there are moderate opposition forces in Syria. They are represented in the parliament. They're not out in the field with a Kalashnikov. They're sitting in Damascus in the parliament and trying to keep law and order and the Syrian government going. So all of that it doesn't matter to CNN. So the idea now is Assad goes to Moscow in an atmosphere of optimism, of success, Syrian Arab Army, Hezbollah, Iran on the ground with Russian air cover. Notice that with a relatively modest fleet of planes, what is it, 40 or 50, they're able to generate 60, 70, 80 sorties per day. And the wretched policy of John Allen, the ISIS czar, had limited the United States to 5 to 10, and half of those came back with the bombs still not jettisoned along the way or dropped on a target. So that's really wretched. And it also points out how easy this is. In other words, if you could just close that Turkish-Syrian border, you shut that, you clobber the ISIS people from the air, the Syrian Arab Army and the auxiliaries go in, they mop up, and it's done. ISIS is a paper tiger. ISIS is not even the junior varsity. It's the intramural teams, right? The interclub or interfraternity athletics. That's who they are. They're pathetic. They are a paper tiger. So there was a big piece of low-hanging fruit available for some smart person. The United States, of course, couldn't because of the obsession by Petraeus coming out of the Anbar Awakening and the Sunni Awakening 10 years ago almost. They couldn't do that because they wanted to keep ISIS as a CIA secret army. In effect, the weakness was there. So somebody came along, and that was a smart guy called Putin. So he did come along. So now the New York Times, the entire tone of the U.S. coverage of the Assad-Putin meeting is sour grapes. Man, are they envious and bitter and consumed by their own treachery. So the New York Times, Bashar al-Assad finds chilly embrace in Moscow trip by Stephen Lee Myers and Anne Barnard. These people are now contending for the Goebbels Prize of the week, October 21st, 2015. And what do we find here? A whole article about how chilly the atmosphere was, which is based on nothing. Nothing except U.S. think tank reports. Here we go. Typical paragraph. New York Times. By all accounts, The two leaders remain distant and wary of each other. The Kremlin in particular has been frustrated by what it sees as Mr. Assad's arrogance and, at least until recently, his unwillingness to bend to Russia's wishes on issues like jump-starting peace talks in Moscow this year and freeing dissidents who might play a role in the political solution. So we get Dmitry Trenin of the Carnegie Moscow Center, great source for the true depiction of the Russian government. And we get a couple of other of these people, similar kinds of think tankers. One long-serving Western diplomat, unnamed, says there's not much chemistry in the Russia to Assad relation. Right? So it's just – this is all just whining and sour grapes. And then when we get to the State Department, it's even worse. The State Department says – we don't like the fact that there was a red carpet treatment for Assad. The red carpet treatment then becomes the headline. Well, my God, this is really, really pathetic, right? Aren't we scraping the bottom of the barrel with the State Department spokesman whining on in this form? Now, despite this, though, we have a couple of positive things. In the background, we've got the U.S., the Pentagon, in effect, right, or CENTCOM, the United States Central Command, under General Lloyd Austin. And we've seen that Austin has had his ups and downs, but in the past month or so, Austin has come down against a no-fly zone, against a safe haven for moderate terrorists in the north of Syria. He was able to reach an understanding with his Russian counterparts, which is a protocol, an agreement between the United States and Russian defense ministries, I guess you could say, which says, in effect, these are the rules of the road. This is sort of the guideline for air traffic control over Syria so that we don't get incidents. We don't have near misses in the air. We don't have people, reconnaissance planes checking out some aircraft, and the aircraft gets nervous, and then something starts to go off. Air Force Secretary Deborah James says it's a recognition we don't want incidents in the air. Okay, good. We'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. So we're looking at this positive sign, right? Sort of understated, but substantive. And that is the arrangement, the deal, the memorandum, which has been signed between the U.S. military and the Russian military to avoid problems in Syria. And again, as the Secretary of the Air Force, Deborah James, that's several layers down from the Secretary of Defense, it's a recognition that we don't want incidents in the air. Now, of course, everybody here goes into CYA mode. We're not endorsing Russia. We don't like what they're doing. They're not being honest, blah, blah, blah. But then there is a deal inked. So that's highly interesting. According to USA Today, the agreement with Russia includes protocols for flying safely over battlefields in Syria and indicates dedicated frequencies for pilots to communicate with each other. There's also one obvious specification is what language do you use? And, of course, it's not automatic for that to be English. It might be automatic for it to be Russian, but it has to be specified by mutual agreement with some element of reciprocity. The interesting thing about this is the eternal warmonger, right? The bellicose demiurge, John McCain, Walnuts McCain, the friend of the MIAs, so-called, but of course he's not. He says this is immoral. It amounts to a betrayal of the moderate terrorists that the U.S. has been backing against Assad. So according to the deal, according to McCain, about the deal. He says what it means is that U.S. pilots will allow the Russian attack planes to take the lead while Iranian-backed Syrian ground forces attack the moderate terrorists. Well, this is what you get, Senator McCain, when you bet on terrorists and consort with terrorists. And we know you're walnuts, McCain, and you are the guy who cavorts with the kidnapper, with the cannibal, and with the caliph. And as you say to Kerry, right, John, you've met all those people. Well, no. McCain says this is not only self-defeating and harmful to our national interests, it is immoral. These people, these wonderful moderate terrorists, that would include the cannibal and the kidnapper, these people put their trust in the United States, believing that we would make good on our promises to help them succeed. Now we are breaking those promises in our haste to give Putin clearer skies from which to bomb our partners. Let's just point out once again, the elementary prerequisite for preventing the collapse of Syria into chaos and the worst terrorist base ever seen in recent history, and, of course, continuing millions upon millions of refugees heading for Europe and the rest of the world. The only way to avoid that is to work with the existing government, the legal government, the government that has never ceased to function on a large part of Syrian territory. They're always showing us the territory of Syria. Show us the population. How much of the population is under the protection of Assad? And you'll see that it's quite substantial. We also have all kinds of whining about this, right? But it's simply true. Now, Nicholas Haras, Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, that's the Petraeus one. The signal it sends is that the United States recognizes that the number one priority of the Russian airstrikes to support the continuation of Assad is a fact on the ground that cannot be reversed. Yes, get that into your head. And it's essential. It's essential. Because if you have the collapse of the Assad government, the collapse of the Syrian state apparatus, then you can't fight ISIS any way, shape, or form. That is the ultimate absurdity of the Allen and Petraeus position. So that's number one. And then we've also got the idea that we're going to have some talks, right? This is now Wall Street Journal, October 21st. The United States and Russia will meet for their first face-to-face talks on Syria since Russian warplanes began flying combat missions there and introducing their own variation into the American-led anti-ISIS campaign. The phony war engineered by Allen, which has opened up this tremendous flank, which Putin intelligently has exploited. But if you're looking for somebody to blame for the defeat, blame Allen and Petraeus and that clique. Those guys always lose, right? This is a clique of defeated generals. They would, in France, they'd all be sent to Limoges. That's what happens to defeated French marshals. So Kerry of the State Department will meet Lavrov, as well as top diplomats from Saudi Arabia, that would be Jubair, and Turkey on Friday in Vienna as the Obama administration grasps for a way to salvage its Middle East agenda. Yeah. Well, there's a public agenda, as we've been told, and then there's a private one, which is different. The meeting follows a visit to Moscow this week by Assad, and that was, of course, a big turning point. Now, on the ground, let's just look at that. The city of Aleppo, it had been the largest, even bigger than Damascus, according to some accounts, pre-war, pre-invasion by these Saudi paid-for jihadis sent in through Turkey. That column, which is now advancing towards Aleppo in the north, this has impacted the Homs area, the Hama area, that's sort of on the way towards Aleppo. And that is now happening. So it's a question of defending what you could call it the Mediterranean coast, what the media like to call the Alawite heartland, which goes from Latakia down to Banyas, down to Tartus. Happened to have visited these areas myself, 2011. So these areas have to be protected. The Russian base, of course, near Latakia. Last week we had a very interesting account, which you can read about also in the briefing, up at Tarpley.net and other locations. You can read about how the Russian air defense had been configured, right? This idea of a bubble and a zone of interdiction, at least potential interdiction, if it came to something nasty. So this is all going on. Things are changing, that in the sense that, as Putin says, the Syrian government has achieved significantly positive results against the various terrorist opposition forces. And this has been going on since September 30th. So we got more than 3 weeks. And again, the Russian sortie number per day is equal to what Allen and company were able to put together in a month or 6 weeks. So it's quite likely that the military situation of the terrorist rebels in general, and that would include Nusra al-Qaeda, but also ISIS soon enough, that will become quite critical. So I think, remember, what the U.S. says in public is one thing. This idea of a different agenda by Obama in the background is another thing. Now, this brings us to the big event of today, that is to say, the 22nd of October. And this is the long-awaited appearance by Madame Clinton in front of the Benghazi pardon me, the Benghazi committee. She's something to sneeze at. Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to Hillary Clinton and the question of Petraeus and Carter Ham, which is not coming up in front of this committee, but which is essential. Back in a minute. Welcome back to Crisis Radio. Just to remind everybody, Rome, Italy, October 26th, Monday, the No Guerra, No NATO conference in Via Cavour. The Cavour Conference Center, Centro Convegni Cavour, and then on October 31st, Halloween, and November 1st, All Saints, I guess. Friedberg, Germany, near Frankfurt, that is within the S-Bahn, I think. If you're in Frankfurt, you can get there very easily. Or if you're in Mainz or Wiesbaden, I think you can get over there. So I hope to see old friends and new friends at both of these. We will improvise contact meetings for the Tax Wall Street Party United Front Against Austerity. Now let's look at Hillary and her appearance, much touted, right? Now you have to remember the prelude to all of this is that Hillary's got all her ducks in a row thanks to the treachery of Bernie Sanders, who saved her in the Democratic debate as these other candidates, such as they were gearing up to make a big gang tackle of Hillary. It was Bernie who broke that momentum and saved her from some kind of criticism about her nefarious and probably illegal practices of keeping her own private email. Not the greatest issue, but whatever it was, that was the issue. And Bernie didn't care about the issue. He cared about being a border guard, a sheepdog, a stalking horse, a flank guard, whatever, gatekeeper. That's Bernie. Now, today, Madame Clinton is up there dealing with essentially a bunch of quite crude, amateurish things coming from Trey Gowdy, Trey unscrupulous, Trey unprepared. And his big deal is, you know, let's look at all these emails, and they're actually deducing. They say, how come you had more emails about Libya in 2011 or 2012? This obviously not going anywhere. There are two sides to this now. Remember, Mrs. Clinton, of course, has the worst of motives, to be sure. She's power hungry and Wall Street representative. And, of course, a warmonger, right? She's a neocon. She is always the biggest warmonger in the room because she has to be. If she's not the biggest warmonger, then from her warped feminist point of view, she says, I'm going to be attacked as a weak woman unless I'm the biggest warmonger. Well, that is, once again, the precise clinical definition of weakness, that you're overcompensating for what you perceive to be your big vulnerability. Benghazi was an October surprise. Why did it take place on September 11th, 2012? Because that's an October surprise in the era of early voting. So the October surprise was killing an ambassador. In terms of the chain of command, the chain of command of the relevant assets did not go to Hillary Clinton, evil though she is, unsuited for the presidency, though she is, for sure. There are two lines. The ground forces, and this is a group of CIA, highly trained knuckle draggers, right? Paramilitaries. And they're in the CIA annex. This came up in the part of the testimony that I heard before starting the show. Madame Clinton referred, just in passing, to an agreement about the CIA annex. Well, there's a CIA annex in Benghazi, and it's between 12 and 20 or more CIA paramilitaries. They were not subjected to the command of Madame Clinton, but to the command of General David Petraeus, the leader of the Bonapartist neocon clique. Therefore, we have to ask him. He was at the movies that night, as I recall. He went to see Argo about getting hostages out of Iran, some kind of a story like this. This reminds me of some of these characters who didn't want to be accountable for Pearl Harbor, how they managed to make themselves scarce on the night of. So, ask Petraeus. Petraeus has not been called. Why not? One, I think even Tapper asked one of these guys on the committee, how come you haven't called Petraeus? He was the head of the CIA. He controlled the armed assets that would have made the difference. Oh, we're not done yet. We're not done yet, said the Republican. Fine. The other side of it is air cover. Petraeus on the ground and then the air. Does it have to come all the way from the northern Adriatic? Does it have to come from Aviano near the border with Slovenia? No. It can come from Sigonella, Sicily. The famous NATO base on Sicily, Sigonella, 1 to 2 hours away. Who controlled those assets? General Carter Ham, the commander of United States African Command, U.S. AFRICOM. So Petraeus on the ground, commanding. Ham, and Ham in the air. That's the thing. So we want grilled Petraeus and grilled Ham. That's our demand. That's what the Tax Wall Street Party should say about something like this, that it's a farce, because you're not talking Sigonella and you're not talking the CIA annex. So the other side of course is how was this brought about? Well, there were two sides to it, right? The killing was apparently done by Sufyan Kumu, Q-U-M-U, and this is a guy who was in Guantanamo concentration camp for a couple of years, very well known to the U.S., undoubtedly made a kind of a deal to get out of there. Those are the ones who did the killing. The people who should have been providing the indigenous ground-based security, the February 17th Martyrs Movement, well, you remember the previous year there had been a rivalry for control of the rebel military, the terrorist rebel military of the Benghazi Rebel Council, and that had fallen to a guy called General Yunus. And the U.S. sent in Khalifa Hifter from practically Langley, Virginia, from the CIA countryside around Langley. So Hifter got in there, and this February 17th Martyrs Brigade were the ones who assassinated Yunus, leaving Hifter in command, and Hifter is still there commanding essentially the military forces of this Benghazi Derna Tobruk terrorist axis, right? One of the biggest breeding grounds, right? Vivarium for terrorists anywhere in the world. Suicide bombers, jihadis, you name it. They've got it all. And it's got to do, of course, with the Senussi Brotherhood. It's got to do with the fact that the British promoted terrorism against the Italians near the Egyptian border, therefore Tobruk, that kind of thing. So this is the background. You look at this, you look with despair at these hearings, right? They're so idiotic. They're so childish. They're so, primitive, and they don't get anywhere near the truth. So, again, the thing that Stevens was doing His last meeting in his lifetime was with a Turkish consular official. Why Turkey, of all things, in Benghazi? Well, because that was his mission. Remember that Stevens had been the ambassador to the U.S. ambassador to the Benghazi Rebel Council, and he was part then of the airlift and sealift operation, which took armed terrorist rebels, the jihadis, out of Libya. Once Gaddafi had been killed, and once the Gaddafi fighting forces had been crushed, all of those crazies had to be shipped to Turkey, Alexandretta, as we've heard, and then into Syria. And a lot of them are still fighting today against Assad. So that is what is going on. And, of course, the libertarians, oh, my God, and the right-wingers and the reactionaries, they just don't get it. It's not going to come home for them. Now, we want to talk about Bernie Sanders. We've done a bit of work this week in the daily briefings. You can see those on tarpley.net. Get yourself a free subscription. If you don't do this, you're missing a great value. If you want to know what's going on. Bernie, of course, saved Mrs. Clinton, as we said before, from a potentially damaging round of questions. And now that Bernie has essentially revealed himself as a stalking horse, we're getting Mrs. Clinton more complacent and more inevitable. Who knows? Yeah, reality may stick in. Back in a minute on World Crisis. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio, and we're recording once again on Thursday, the 22nd of October. Now, we're going to have a report from Rome, Italy, and this is from Pino Cabras, a very good friend. Pino is the head of Megachip. Megachip is one of the leading alternative websites in Italy. It's megachip.info, I believe, if you take a look. One of the things you can always find there is whatever Giulietto Chiesa has been doing lately. People remember Giulietto Chiesa from the 9/11 truth movement days back in 2006, 2007, 2008. He was a member of the European Parliament at that time, and he was one of the highest ranking European officials to have some interest in the alternative explanations. So let me welcome Pino Cabras and hope that he can bring us up to date on the preparations for this Congress on Monday, October 26th, and also, the reasons why. What is the need, I think, for a conference like this at this time? Pino, welcome.
Hi, Webster. How are you?
Great. I'm so glad you can join me. So I guess you heard it, right? You're one of the prime movers behind this conference. So tell us all about the conference.
Yeah, the conference will be in Rome, and it will gather movements from all over Europe, movements, parties, members of parliament that are against this big war game called the Trident Juncture that has started in these days in Italy, Portugal, and Spain, and will involve 40,000 soldiers.
And again, on this program, whenever we hear drill or exercise, we always think, is it going to go live? Because that, unfortunately, is what happens with these things from time to time. So we certainly join in the demand that this thing be shut down, right? This should simply be canceled, called off. The Mediterranean is much too hot, right, with the Russians flying in Syria and all kinds of possible problems emerging. Just call this thing off. But now also, if this is with, yes, go ahead.
Now, yes, this is a possible problem because always the exercise have a real extension that in every moment could be transformed in something else. In a way, they are already real because they have an enormous impact on the territories that are involved. For example, in Sardinia, the island where I live normally, there is an enormous impact in the environment. because they shot an incredible quantity of ammo. And all the transport system is interfered with some restriction. And so it's already real. And we feel that is a way to prepare a war in a larger scale, because there are involved 27 countries.
Yes, it's supposedly, it's either the biggest since 1999, or some even say the biggest going back even further, but certainly very big and therefore very untimely. But now, how about the idea of, for example, Italy leaving NATO, becoming a neutral country, right? Pursuing national interests. And we know, our audience here knows the sad story of things like the Moro assassination, the role of the CIA, constant destabilizations. Anybody who wanted to assert some kind of an independent line was immediately targeted. And I guess that has now built up to a point where people say this is simply not worth it.
Yeah, you know very well the history of Italy and Europe in the year 70s, when the presence of NATO structures influenced the politics of many states. It was a sort of experiment for the further revolutions that were made, fabricated by NATO structures. It's a way to have an occupied country when you have the presence of NATO. The problem is that many countries in the Eastern Europe in the recent years have built up a presence of military structures that are offensive, not defensive as they were supposed to be in previous times. And now for Italy is quite an issue to liberate itself from 90 NATO and the U.S. bases that constitute a sort of occupation of the territory.
Right. And also the constant interference in internal affairs. I mean, Aldo Moro once said we need to have the Christian Democrats and the communists to have a stable government with a large majority and actually have reforms. And somebody like Henry Kissinger was reportedly telling him, don't you dare. And that kind of, you know, clashes with prime ministers like Craxi in the 1980s and even more recently, right? The whatever you think of Berlusconi, it's also clear that he was overthrown, too, by something like NATO.
Yeah, he was prone to certain desires of the empire for a long time. But at the same time, he was able to build new relations with other countries that are not really loved by the Washington clan. And after this independence in certain movements, Berlusconi was targeted by many actions, delegitimation, etc., and he lost most of his power.
And I think people know, right? He was a close personal friend of Putin, and that seemed to be the big issue for the NATO people.
Yes, the NATO first task in this moment is to avoid an increase of the relation between Europe and Russia. For NATO, is vital to cut every relation between two sides of Europe. We continue to consider Russia, for example, a part of Europe, a strategic asset of a common security, a common protection.
Sure.
While in this moment they are trying to separate definitely the Russian system from the European one. And many leaders in Europe have this strange relation with America because they are blackmailed. They are not really independent in many aspects, but at the same time, they have a relation with their industrial system that finds more convenient to have a stronger relation with Russia or other countries. I mean, Russia as a hub of relations with all the Eurasia system.
Right, and we have this tradition of Fiat automobiles and trucks being built in Russia. There's a very long tradition of cooperation there. So in terms of the conference, could you give us some idea of a couple of people who are coming?
Yeah, there will be important members of the parliament from Germany, from Norway, from Greece, from Italy as well.
Great.
And also from the European Parliament. There are a lot of people. It's an incredible crowded conference in a way.
Okay, Pino, so, I'm sorry. The music is on. We have these hard picks built in. Thank you very much. I'll see you very soon, and I'll see you certainly on Monday the 26th in Rome. And thank you so much.
See you. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we'll be right back on World Crisis. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, earlier in our broadcast, we did a rundown on the visit of Syrian President Assad to President Putin in Moscow. But now we can get the invaluable perspective of Thierry Masson speaking to us from Syria, from Damascus. And this, of course, is a person who has been the only Western reporter that we know of who has been in Syria continuously. He's actually been a consultant for the Syrian government and gives you a view that, indeed, you're not going to get in any of the U.S. mainstream media. So, Thierry, welcome. And then please tell us, why did President Assad go to Moscow at this time?
So first you have to understand that for President Assad it was very difficult to go outside his own country because during the first year of war in 2011 there was a lot of manipulation tricks from the Western governments and they tried to organize the coup d'etat inside the country. So during the first year he was very cautious about that. And since the Geneva Conference in June 2012, a new war restarts, a totally different, a very hard war, and with a lot of jihadists coming from everywhere in the world. And President Assad became the head of the army. And as the head of the army, he was not able to leave the battle and to go to United Nations or to Moscow or everywhere. So during 5 years, he was always in Syria. But this changed with the results of the Russian military campaign in Syria. Right now, the situation is more flexible, and President Assad decided to go to Moscow. But of course, this was very difficult in the for security reasons. He has to fly over some jihadist territories or over NATO territories. And in one case, in the both case, it could be, his plane could be destroyed by jihadists or by NATO.
Right.
So that's why this trip was totally secret, including the ambassador in Moscow. He doesn't know that the president was coming, the Syrian ambassador. All the trip was organized by the Russians. And why this trip? If you are reading the New York Times or Washington Post, you will read some stupidity because they think that the topic of the meeting was about the military situation or about the way to compose the next government with people from the opposition, the moderates. Of course, it's not necessary to organize a meeting like that for such topics. There is a lot of links between the two states. They have a lot of meetings at very high level, not the president, but very high level between the two states. The real aim of this meeting was to know how Syria could participate to the Russian plan for peace in the Arab world, not only in the Middle East, but also in North Africa. And as you know, as Syria is a local country where everybody can live exactly with the same rights, without distinction of ethnies, religions, or political parties, this could be an example for the other country in the Arab world. This was the real topic of that meeting. And as you see in that meeting, you have only President Assad for Syria, but for Russia, you have President Putin, you have the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Minister of Defense, the General Secretary for the National Security Council, and the head of the Secret Services. So they can discuss all the topics about the way to make peace in this part of the world.
So, in other words, Syria is a secular country, right? It's not based on any particular religion, open to all, and
yes,
tolerant, right? Christians, Druzes, Kurds, Sunni, Shia, whatever, Alawite, all tolerated, all getting
yes,
along under the older system.
Yes, and you know that since the beginning of the war, the Western media tried to say that Syria is an Alawite regime or Alawite dictature, they say. So this is totally stupid. Of course, the president himself is Alawite, but most of the leaders are not Alawite at all. They are from different religions and sects. From the some are Christian, some are Sunni, some are Shia, some are Druze, from different religions. And this is very important in the ideology of the Baath Party, which is now at power in Syria. Of course, it's a national union government, but the main party is always the Baath Party. And for the Baath Party, the secular system is something absolutely necessary in that part of the world because of the diversity of the people. Yes.
But then the Russian plan for the pacification of the Middle East, is it going to be an international conference? Can you point us in maybe a little bit more detail on that?
Of course, all this is very difficult to organize because first we have to know exactly what the U.S. will do or not do, because as you explained to your audience since long years, there is now a big division inside the U.S. administration, and people like Ambassador Samantha Power or number two of the United Nations, Jeffrey Feltman, they are totally opposed to the peace. They push for a general war and a big chaos in the Arab world. But it seems that President Obama himself is ready to make peace if he can impose his own policy to his own administration.
Right.
And at the end of this meeting, the Kremlin announced that they will try to organize a new meeting with probably John Kerry for the United States, somebody for Saudi Arabia, and a third one for Turkey. But
right,
unfortunately, we don't know who will be able to represent Turkey. There is now no government. There is a transitional government
okay,
in Turkey. You will have new elections the first.
Kerry, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We do have that confirmed in the Wall Street Journal that there's going to be this face-to-face meeting. So thank you very much. We only have the one segment, and we'll see you again very soon. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So we've heard from Pino Capras. That's Rome on the 26th of October. Centro Convegni Cavour in Via Cavour. And then actually, I'll be speaking November 1st. Conference is Halloween and November 1st, and that's in Friedberg, Germany, in the Frankfurt am Main area. Now, we were talking about Bernie, and this is actually, it's quite striking how this has worked, right? We saw in the Democratic debate at the very moment when these other candidates, weak though they are, right, O'Malley and Webb and Link, Chafee, they were getting ready to give their best shot at Madame Secretary there about, I think it would have been the emails, it would have been Benghazi, but it would have been also something about, you know, is this this policy good? Right? Who knows? Maybe that's what we're thinking. But Bernie stepped in, and Bernie said, I don't think your emails are a political issue. I don't care about them. I'm sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails. And she was delighted. She shook hands. She fairly gurgled with pleasure. So now I think it's clear that Bernie is a sheepdog, if you will. We have all kinds of authoritative, right, highly respected websites that talk about Bernie in these, I think, realistic terms, very unflattering, very, blunt, that Bernie has been acting as a sheepdog for Hillary Clinton. You know what the sheepdog does, right? If the sheep begin to stray off the ranch, off the reservation, then the sheepdog goes to work and brings them back in. And one of the points, I think one of the more interesting articles is the one by Bruce Dixon in the Black Agenda report, right? I think this is one of the most important, most authentic voices of the Black community. So Bruce Dixon and Glenn Ford over there, right, and their fine team have put together this analysis, which they've had for a while. Bernie is the sheepdog. And in particular, they point out that the Democratic Party has a track record of putting out a kind of a sheepdog, or what I would call a stalking horse, a border guard, a gatekeeper, a left flank guard in particular, in the years when there is no incumbent, when there's no Democratic incumbent. If you have a Democratic incumbent like Obama 2012, right, it's very difficult to get anything going in the Democratic Party against an incumbent Democratic president. But in various years, they have put this out, right? Bruce Dixon actually considers Jesse Jackson 1988 as such a kind of flank guard, or as he puts it, sheepdog. And in particular, you look at Howard Dean, for example. Howard Dean, right, 2004. Howard Dean in Vermont was considered a real right-wing Democrat, right, a conservative Democrat, as well he might be, right? It's Howard Dean of Dean Witter. Dean Witter, a large Wall Street brokerage, and so a rich guy with a big Wall Street connection. But then somehow he gets profiled as the most radical anti-war candidate. Remember his mantra? He represented the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party rather than the part that wanted to make compromises. I would also point out Kucinich, right, in 2004. He was there, and especially in 2008. So Kucinich would essentially occupy that space. He'd suck people in with the help of his economics advisors like Michael Hudson, who was part of this. They'd all come in there, and people would be frozen in place, right? They would not leave the Democratic Party, but they would be sucked back into it, right? That would be the other thing, would be maybe a vacuum cleaner that's bringing them back in. So you have Counterpunch has been doing yeoman service, and you've had others who have been pointing this out. We've also got people going back to rediscover commentaries about Bernie from 1999. 1999, of course, was the year of the bombing of Serbia on the flimsiest of pretexts. Actually, in retrospect, it was completely unjustified. It was done on the basis of hysteria. Christian Amanpour, Al Gore, all cooperated. Prince Charles evidently cooperated to start bombing Serbia. It's one of the greatest acts of historical vandalism. They blew up the bridges over the Danube River. They interfered with commerce of the entire Danube River basin. This was an act of real, again, despicable vandalism on the part of the Clinton administration. Again, maybe more Gore than Clinton, but still the buck stops somewhere, stops with Clinton. Bernie was a leading guy in that. Right? So he's somebody who can't be trusted. He's a border guard. And what you get out of this this essay, you can see this on my website, right? The briefing for Wednesday, October 21st. Awareness is growing of the treachery of the man called by anti-war people in Vermont. He's called Bernie the Bomber. Since 1999, he's been Bernie the Bomber. He is a humanitarian bomber. He would mean wider wars if he gets to the White House. He's a sheepdog, a stalking horse, a flank guard. And he's got this amazing, I think, quite obsolete idea that the social democratic societies of Scandinavia, the Swedish welfare state, the Danish welfare state, if we can call it that, that these are somehow exemplary and ought to be imitated. The statistics I've been able to find online is that the abject poverty rate in Denmark is about 13.5%, and the U.S. is 1 or 2 points higher. This is not anything to write home about, right? And of course, there is this question of a virtually totalitarian bureaucracy. If they don't like your political opinions, there is a danger that your children will be taken away. That is not made up, right? I knew a very well-known Swedish lawyer, Lennart Hane, H-A-N-E, who his specialty as a lawyer was to try to help people to get their own children back after they've been taken away by social workers because of the political opinions of the parents. That is heavy, heavy stuff. Now, the thing about Bernie also, he's supposed to be a socialist. He says he's a democratic socialist. Now, let's put that back into context, because to some people, that seems like a change. Some of them might say, oh, it's refreshing after all this stuff. But you got to look back into this, right? The kind of socialism that he's talking about is the Socialist Party of the United States. And that is the old Norman Thomas, Princeton, socialists. The Socialist Party of the United States, was long known as the State Department Socialists. These were operatives, right? And they share a kind of a common matrix with the neocons. In other words, if you're looking at socialists and social democrats, right-wing socialists and social democrats in the 20s, then into the 30s, into the 40s and 50s, you're going to see that the sources of the neocons are not so different, really, from the sources of the of somebody like Bernie, who calls himself a democratic socialist, right? And in particular, we're talking about something called YPSL, Young People's Socialist League. A really smelly organization, which we'll discuss in the next segment. Back in a minute. Welcome to the final segment of this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarp here in Washington, D.C. One last reminder, and that is if you're in Rome, if you're in central Italy or anywhere on that epic peninsula, stop by Rome on Monday, the 26th of October. The conference is No to War and No to NATO. And that's going to be at the Cavour Conference Center, Centro Convegni Cavour, Via Cavour, 50A, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on October 26th. And then on October 31st to November 1st, the Querdenken Conference at Friedberg, Germany, near Frankfurt. Look that up under Querdenken Kongress, Quer-Denken-Kongress.de. So I look forward to seeing friends. We will organize some kind of a gathering, some kind of a reception or something for the various people from the Tax Wall Street Party. Now, let's just look at when Bernie says democratic socialist, how do you get to be a democratic socialist? Well, the Socialist Party of Norman Thomas shrank very fast after the 1920s. And, of course, it was always run by this rich guy from Princeton. So this is already quite problematic. But it had certain radical elements in the 1920s. But those were then thrown overboard. And in particular, the youth branch of this. Now, this went through various evolutions, but it's called YPSL, Y-P-S-L, YPSL, Young People's Socialist League. Now, who were they? Those guys were the mushheads of earlier decades, right? This was not class struggle. This was not militant, you know, pro-labor, strike support, cross-union caucus, bringing in the unemployed. No. This was practically something you could put on your college application. In other words, it was closely linked to SANE, S-A-N-E, which was the SANE nuclear policy, right? It was the anti-nuclear weapons organization, which was quite large in the 50s, 60s, right? SANE. So there was a symbiosis of those two groups. You also have to look at what happened, you know, with this question of the Soviet Union and communism, and basically it was that the Socialist Party and YPSL were strongly anti-Soviet, anti-communist by the time we get into the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, right? They're very, very much on an anti-Moscow, anti-communist party line, right? So, and this means that they're functioning as essentially as a border guard for the Democratic Party vis-a-vis these so-called Marxists, if that's what they were. And you can see that, therefore, this vocation of being a border guard for the Democratic Party is what a lot of these so-called socialist groups have been doing now, once again, for many decades. One of the people you got to be aware of in this thing is a guy called Schachtman, Max Schachtman, the Schachtmanites. And this guy was a Trotskyist. He was working with Leon Trotsky. And then along comes the Hitler-Stalin pact, right? The Ribbentrop-Molotov pact, when a lot of people said, oh, I can't be a part of this anymore, right? Look, Stalin is making a deal with Hitler. And of course, this was, very disturbing for many reasons. But these people, they drew certain lessons of their own, right? And so it's James Burnham, who later on became a reactionary. He became part of the William Buckley Circle. Burnham, writing, you know, National Review, this stuff. And then this guy, Max Schachtman. And eventually they joined the Socialist Party in the 1950s. So it means that young people in those families would have had a chance of going into YPSL, Young People's Socialist League. So Bernie was a member of the Young People's Socialist League. That is a very right-wing, very petty bourgeois, very much modern mushhead version of this entire thing. So you're looking at, again, the matrix for the neocons is not so different. In other words, you could have had somebody among the Schachtmanites. One of them would stay nominally a socialist, and the others, you know, the Crystals and the Podhoretzes and so forth, they would or they're that ilk, they would fly off and become, you know, more and more reactionary as time went by. And that's what Bernie comes from. There was another thing called SEDUSA, Social Democrats USA, S-D-U-S-A, SEDUSA. And that also would, those guys could call themselves also democratic, socialists. So, you got people like Muravchik, right? Joshua Muravchik, and others, right, who have evolved way, way to the right. Crystal, you know, that family, a lot of neocons coming from this general ambient. So social being a democratic socialist, not a good thing. And therefore, we would say kudos to Bruce Dixon at the Black Agenda Report. Kudos to Counterpunch magazine for a very significant sustained effort. But he is Bernie is a sheepdog. And look, after you saw that handshake, after you saw that symbiosis, that convergence, right, that, you know, one hand washes the other that we saw in that debate, don't say that you weren't warned. Don't say that you were fooled and it's not your own fault, right? People who are duped by Bernie at this point are duped because they want to be. And the stuff that we're getting from Bernie, right, that we have to have a popular revolution with millions of people in the streets, for what? We're going to have a popular revolution for campaign finance reform? This is crazy. People need debt relief on the student loan front. They need to be protected against foreclosures. They need a living wage. They need a union. We got to have a 15% protective tariff. Above all, a 1% Wall Street sales tax to finance the federal budget and the really big one, seizing control in whole or in part or increasingly the Federal Reserve System, 0% 100-year credit to create 30 million new jobs through a program to comprehensively rebuild U.S. infrastructure. Perhaps a lighter note, little Rand Paul is going through this slow-motion collapse. We're looking forward for that to terminate, right? We've been watching it with benevolent interest, but now it's time for it to cease. Now, the other one is Trump, the wrecking ball, Donald Sampson Trump, pulling down the temple of the Philistines on the heads of the Philistines, attacking the civic myth, right, the oligarchical consensus that says that the 9/11 story is somehow untouchable, and the absurd contention by Jeb Bush, my brother kept us safe. Well, he didn't. Look at there with all these 3,000 people. Some way or other, he didn't. I don't believe the official version. As you know, you should look at 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, the fifth edition, if you please. We've even got a couple of things coming out on it, right? We've got this thing called Operation Fertile Rice, which was Osama bin Laden attacking a drill. It was Osama bin Laden attacking New York with a drone about a month before 9/11. We've also got this idea that Russia may have satellite photos which would tend to undermine the U.S. story. But let me just get to this. The problem with Bush, Jeb Bush, George W. Bush, I don't believe that George W. Bush was the planner or the kingpin or the master of 9/11. It's absurd. He's a moron. He can't be. He's told to follow orders, keep his head down, do what he's told, right? That's the story. But when in the beginning of August you get a piece of paper that says Osama bin Laden determined to strike in the United States, then what can you do? Well, you go back and look at what even somebody like Clinton did in late 1999 when there was this millennium bomb threat. You organize a task force, set up agents process, you put out alerts, mobilize, you slap on extra combat air patrols over the cities, you do all that. Bush the younger did nothing. So it's malfeasance and nonsense, above all nonfeasance, that we refuse to condemn George Bush the younger. Check the article by Benjamin DeMott in Harper's Magazine in 2004. You can find all of that in the daily briefing displayed on Tarpley.net, Tarpley.net, and hope to see some in Rome on Monday the 26th. Thank you so much. See you next time.